This is PCJ Radio International.
On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is Media Network Plus.
Well, hello, friends. It's very nice, as always, to have you with us for another edition of the program. I'm Keith Parent. Coming up today, we're going to be talking about RNTC. What is RNTC? That stands for Radio Netherlands Training Center. It's a part of Radio Netherlands Worldwide, and the work they do is absolutely amazing. We're also going to be hearing today about the hearing that took place this month in Ottawa, Canada, concerning the cutbacks by the CBC to Radio Canada International. We're also going to be finding out from a young guy, a very young guy, who started a radio station when he was still a teenager. And he still is a teenager. We have this and much more, so stay tuned. This is Media Network Plus, telling you about things that you probably know about, but we don't care, we're giving a little bit more background. This month, a Canadian Senate panel for the Canadian senators had invited to a hearing the president of the CBC and the director of Radio Canada International. They were there to answer questions about why a small percent cut to the CBC led to an 80% cut to Radio Canada International. Last year, Radio Canada International ceased all shortwave broadcasts and also cut languages and reduce their programming and now remain a service just online. This hearing into the cuts for Radio Canada International was organized by Canadian Senator Hugh Siegel, who we had on the program a few months ago. There were a lot of surprising things about what happened, and we're now going to be taking a look at them.
Radio Canada International.
Radio Canada International.
Well, a few months ago, Paulette, as you may remember, we had Senator Hugh Siegel on the program.
Right.
And he was raising questions about why a 20% cut to the CBC's budget would translate to an 80% cut of Radio Canada International's budget.
Mm-hmm.
So he called for this Senate hearing, which happened on May 1st in Ottawa. So the president of the CBC and the director of Radio Canada International had to appear in front of the Senate to answer questions.
So was this the first time? Like, how did it get to his attention? And you know, has it appeared or has this issue come forth before the Senate before? Or is this the first time?
This is not the first time. Certainly not the first time, but it's the first time that, well, let me put it diplomatically, it's the first time that it was handled with a little bit of suspicion on the part of the CBC. Now, previous Senate hearings into budget cuts to Radio Canada International always had the director of the CBC, and also, of course, the director of Radio Canada International. They also had, of course, testimonies from others in the international broadcast business, you can say, to put their thoughts forward to give the senators asking the questions a better idea of what international broadcasting does. Now, you know, you're talking about senators here, Paulette. You know, they're going to so many different hearings, they can't be an expert and know exactly what's happening on every single one.
Right, so you're saying in the past then they really didn't know too much about it, so they kind of would go along, they would take whatever was presented to them as okay and not look into it very deeply because of their lack of expertise and knowledge of international broadcasting?
Well, that's what they did this time. Now, previous at hearings, like I said, they would always have, say, witness testimony. Sort of like, you know, when the CRTC is granting a license to a radio station, mm-hmm. they have people that come forward with their thoughts, right?
Right.
But
right.
this time, that was not done. That was not done. The CBC, from my sources, tell me that their lawyers had been negotiating to not allow any witness testimony to come forward. So it was only, in fact, the CBC and Radio Canada International. I had put a letter of testimony forward. I know a number of other people that had, and it was all pushed aside. So it was the CBC, in fact, controlling the Senate hearing, because the senators were only getting what the CBC felt that they should be told.
Oh, that's interesting. So who then was representing the CBC, and what did they say? What did they have to say for themselves?
Well, the CBC was represented by Hubert Lacroix, who's the president of the CBC. Mm-hmm. And this is what he had to say in his opening statement.
Our decision to end shortwave broadcasts of RCI and move the service to the Internet was not an easy one, nor was it taken lightly. Like all of our budget decisions, we looked carefully at the service, its cost, and how we could best protect the value it provides to Canadians. The reality is that the use of shortwave around the world has been declining since the end of the Cold War. That combined with the growth of cellular phones, internet, traditional radio, and television, this has led broadcasters around the world to cut back on their shortwave services if they do maintain them at all. For example, BBC World closed 5 languages services and has eliminated shortwave broadcasts to Canada, Australia, and the United States. Voice of America has curtailed its short and medium wave broadcasts to Albania, Georgia, Iran, and Latin America, along with English language broadcasts to the Middle East and Afghanistan. In Switzerland, Swiss Info shut down its shortwave in 2004 and now only broadcasts on the web. And 5 days after RCI ended its shortwave-based broadcasts, Radio Netherlands did the same.
That was the president of the CBC, Hubert Lacroix, making his opening statement. And I want to correct a few things that he said there.
Okay.
He said, and he said it clearly, that the BBC World Service, for example, stopped shortwave broadcasts to North America. Now, what he didn't mention is that this was more than 10 years ago. The impression that this leaves is, and I know from speaking to a few other people that heard it as well, it gives the impression that the BBC World Service just stopped doing this.
So why would they want to create that impression?
Well, the CBC and RCI has had a bit of a turbulent relationship going back a number of years. And this is no... within even the world of international broadcasting, broadcasters from overseas already knew this. For a long time, the budget of RCI was handed from the CBC to Foreign Affairs to Heritage Canada, back to Foreign Affairs to the CBC. It's like a whole drama. Back in 1990, in the early 1990s, when I was still doing, well, just after I stopped doing stuff at RCI, and speaking to people who had worked at RCI for many years, you know, kept saying, and even people on the outside, you know, the CBC wants to get rid of RCI. They don't want to pay for it. They don't want to pay for it. And people have been saying this going back to the early 1990s. And the CBC, of course, was always denying that. But everybody knew, because every time the budget was handed over back to the CBC always did, how would I put it, sort of funny things. Like, for example, RCI's mandate was to provide a shortwave services in areas that they could not reach by satellite or the internet.
Okay. That's pretty clear.
The CBC had this mandate changed secretly. So that meant the CBC was not required for RCI to continue a shortwave service. People only found out about it about 4 months after it happened.
Now, was this when Senator Hugh Segal came on the scene?
This was just before he came on the scene. I think it's because of this, it alerted him, you know, something strange is going on here.
So I would call, we interviewed him last fall, and he mentioned this hearing, and I think one previous as well. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious, because I was the one who spoke to him as to what the follow-up was. He was looking forward to really asking some tough questions. So were there any tough questions, anybody else besides Senator Segal who was asking them?
Well, tough questions. I think we could write a comedy program about this. And again, you know, you have to understand, and of course, I'm not blasting Canadian senators or anybody who is in that kind of position, because, you know, throughout the week, sometimes they're hearing 3-4 different things.
Mm-hmm.
So any information that's given to them is given to them by their civil servants and whoever it is they're going to be asking questions to. So, of course, if information is left out, they're going to go in there and just ask some basic general questions. Now, this whole Senate hearing into the cuts to the CBC and RCI was a bit farcical, because you could sense that maybe the senators wanted to ask more questions, but because they didn't have enough information to ask more questions, it was basically the CBC for over an hour patting themselves on the back, saying, you see, look, we reduced our budget by 20%, but we can actually move forward now.
Say again? What?
Exactly. Exactly. The senators didn't have enough information. Now, there was one senator that did ask a question about RCI dropping shortwave, saying, how do you plan to penetrate certain markets where, let's say, there's internet censorship or the internet can be turned off in a flash, right?
Yes. So what did they, how did they respond?
Well, this was rather funny, because Hélène Perron, of who's the director of RCI, she and also Hubert Lacroix said, oh, you know what? Okay, we dropped shortwave, but there's markets now that can download our programming and incorporate it into their own local programming. Now, this is where bells went off in my head. Now, while that is true in some cases, right, for years, for more than 10 years, Radio Canada International's website has been blocked in China.
Exactly.
Now, if they're claiming that their programs in Chinese are running on Chinese radio stations, they are, I don't know what it is they're smoking. Because there is a law in China from the State Administration of Film, Radio, and Television that forbids content from foreign broadcasters to be used on domestic radio stations.
Now, does Senator Segal and other senators know this?
I don't think they do, because, unfortunately, the information that was given to them came from the CBC. And because, okay. And you see, because other witnesses were not allowed to come forward, so even, let's say, somebody wanted to appear, they had to write a testimony before. The normal procedure is that testimony would have been handed to the senators. They would have had more information about who they're going to be speaking to, but that wasn't done.
So this hearing is much different from previous hearings in the past.
Oh, totally. Because in the past, when experts came forward, or for example, people like Victor, for example, if he sent a testimony in from Sri Lanka to talk about the importance of shortwave, let's say, to Southeast Asia, the senators would say to the CBC, well, you have to restore their funding.
So things were cooked and orchestrated so that the senators would not understand the situation and be able to put the proper pressure on them?
Right. And, you know, the thing is, I'm not blaming the senators here. I'm really not blaming the senators.
Well,
because,
I understand,
you know,
yeah.
You know, they're in the position. I mean, like I said, they're doing so many hearings. They if they don't have information that's in front of them, they can only go so far. But this was everybody who paid attention to it and listened to the hearing on May 1st saying this was orchestrated by the CBC to do exactly this. And this, people have been saying that for years the CBC has wanted to do this.
Well, I recall that. Yes, for decades, mm-hmm. actually. And the CBC, and is it simply a matter of economics, Keith? Is it just that they don't want to pay for it? They have other things that they would rather put the money towards?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with when you have situations where, say, national public broadcasters are in charge of their external services, the problem is, you need people in the external services that know about international broadcasting. At the CBC, there is nobody who knows about international broadcasting. So when the CBC appoints somebody to RCI as a director or manager, they're just sort of dumping them over there. I mean, the joke within the CBC is that, oh, we send managers who are on their last legs to RCI.
Oh, what a shame. How is this happening?
Well, it's because since the early 1990s, there's been, you know, RCI has been passed around from one place to the other, that it's gotten a little bit out of control. Now, in countries, for example, like the United States, international broadcasting is not handled by broadcasters. It's handled by the Broadcasting Board of Governors. Now, with what's happened with RCI, it's having a bit of a rippling effect, because next year the BBC World Service is having their budget transferred to the domestic service of the BBC, which is paid for by the TV license.
Oh, deja vu all over
it's
again?
It's deja vu, and everybody's saying this is exactly what's going to happen, and we've seen similar things in other countries before. If we take New Zealand, for example, Radio New Zealand International belongs to Radio New Zealand, the domestic service. And for a short time, the budget was handed over to the domestic service, but the domestic service wanted to cut their budget. So the government stepped in and said, okay, you know what, we'll put it under you, but we're still going to take care of the budget, because domestic services don't have the know-how, they don't have the background for international broadcasting. And it's the same story that repeats itself over and over and over. And I predicted earlier this year that the BBC World Service by the year 2018 will be tiny. I predicted it, and I will even put money on it. That's how sure I am.
Oh, what a shame. What a shame.
You know, I mean, RCI's, okay, despite the fact there are problems with RCI, and like every organization, you know, but RCI's budget and mandate should, because it's part of public diplomacy.
Of course.
It should be handled by Foreign Affairs.
Yes.
It should be handled by Foreign Affairs and not the CBC, because, you know, the CBC has made a mess of it. But it's become, you know, it's sort of like nobody wants to take responsibility. You know, one government in Ottawa wants to do this, another one wants to do this. So they're just sort of they're like a ping pong ball that's going around. Now, when you think about it in the grand scheme of things, RCI's budget now is $2.3 million. Before the budget cut, it was $12.3 million.
Wow.
And it was one of the least expensive international services in the world. When you calculate how much money from Canadians actually went into the service, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you and I have more change in our pocket, you know?
But, you know, it's very, to me, it's very strange that this is a treasure that nobody can seem to recognize, you know, in the power circles.
Well, you know, I think a lot of it, Paulette, also has to do, okay, if we talk, let's say, about Canada's position in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Canada's position in the world was a lot stronger 20 years ago than it is now. If I take, say, here in the Asia Pacific, right? Canada's diplomatic missions have shrunk.
And do you think that RCI had anything to do with Canada's public foreign image?
Oh, in many parts of the world, I mean, it was. If you talk to people that learned about Canada, they learned about it through RCI, because it was the RCI and at one time the CBC International Service. They were the only window into Canada. Now, what they do well, and some people will say, yeah, but they have the internet now. People can go on the internet, and that's true. But the thing is, you know, news websites in Canada or the domestic service of the CBC are not written for an international audience.
Good point.
You know, RCI would write about Canada for an international audience. So, for example, on CBC Radio, they can just say, oh, I'll give you a small example. They can say, today in Newfoundland, this happened in St. John's. Now, this RCI would say, in Newfoundland, on the east coast of Canada, in the provincial capital of St. John's, they would give more detail so people have a better idea where it is.
Right, right.
This is what RCI has done extremely well. So, it gave a lot of information to people about Canada.
Mm-hmm.
The same way that, say, the Voice of America does,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
or the BBC World Service. But unfortunately, in Canada, they never, especially over in the last 20 years,
mm-hmm.
It's sort of like they've forgotten all that. I mean, during the Cold War, right,
mm-hmm.
Radio Canada International, or as it was called a long time ago, the CBC International Service, was one of the first stations to target communist countries in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. One of the first.
Call the PCJ answer line at country code 44-20-3286-1399. That's country code 44-20-3286-1399 and leave your comments and questions. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is PCJ Radio.
And you're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. This is the monthly edition of the program. There's also a weekly version of the show heard on the World Radio Network and through great partner stations everywhere. Coming up a little later on in the program, I'm going to be telling you about some shortwave test transmissions that we have targeting Southeast and East Asia from the Trincomalee site in Sri Lanka. So stay tuned for that. Radio Netherlands Worldwide. Well, this is a name, of course, that many SWLs remember. I say remember because Radio Netherlands Worldwide as a radio station is long gone. But they do have a training center that goes back to the late 1960s that does absolutely amazing work. They train journalists and broadcasters from around the world. Joining us next on the program is Tony Wilkinson from the Radio Netherlands Training Center. He joins us sitting in a studio in Hilversum, Holland, to tell us a little bit more about how the RNTC began.
Yeah, certainly. We go back actually a long way. We were established in 1968. As part of the idea really to support a lot of countries that were becoming independent, particularly in Africa, and they were setting up their own media organizations, and they needed skilled media people to work for those organizations. And that was the thinking behind the establishment of RNTC. And we started running courses from 1969 onwards. And initially, they were very much professional courses directed at giving people professional knowledge and skills to work in the media. And gradually, through the years, it became more, if you like, development-oriented in the sense that we wanted to make certain that the types of things they were doing in RNTC courses were relevant to topics, subjects, issues in their own countries. So rather than coming here and making stories about clogs and windmills, maybe it's better, for instance, to focus on issues that are important to you, which could be some of the themes that we now include, for instance, good governance, social conflict and cohesion. We've got courses devoted to water, for instance, the water issues. We've got courses devoted to international justice. As you may know, The Hague is the sort of center of international justice, The Hague in the Netherlands. So having a course which looks at the institutions of international justice and thinks about how journalists can cover issues to do with international justice, that's also very much part of what RNTC now does these days. But our basic commitment to people working in the media is the same. We're still focusing on journalists, on program makers, on managers within media organizations, and on people who are also training or educating people, either students who are going to work in the media sector or people who are already working in the media sector who need mid-career training and so forth. And we're still very much targeting that same group, but the content of our courses, of course, has changed over the years.
Now, of course, since RNTC started, there have been, of course, major developments in media, especially in the last 10 years, with the uprising of social media. Gone are the days that if a story was broadcast, you'd never hear it again. Today, sometimes the story's on social media before it's out by any major, radio station or television station. So do you also have to today incorporate social media in this course?
Very much so. And of course, it's what makes my job tremendously exciting. I've been working for RNTC now since, basically 1990. So a long time, 20 years. And during that time, of course, we've seen fantastic changes in the media over the years. And it continues to remain, therefore, a very exciting and interesting profession that that we're involved in. And of course, the arrival of social media, well, first of all, of course, internet, and gradually the increasing importance of social media, is very much part of what we now include in our courses. So that, for instance, our traditional broadcast journalism course, the second part of it, will very much focus also on multimedia journalism and on including social media in the mix. How can a journalist use social media, for instance, to do research, but also to interact more with your audience and also to publicize much more what you're doing, to get reactions, even contributions to the content of what you're doing. So social media is very much part of the mix, always within the existing courses that we run, but also we have a couple of courses which are very much focused on social media. For instance, we have one called Mastering Social Media, which is entirely dedicated to what journalists can actually do with social media. And we have online journalism, which includes, of course, social media in that mix. So the number of courses which place an even greater emphasis on the involvement of social media in journalism, in media these days, and others which have it as a sort of module or part of it, or part of the mix when you're, for instance, working on course assignments, so that you include social media in the way you work.
Now, with the training center, I mean, you're getting journalists from so many different countries around the world. And, I mean, as you know as well as I do, and many other people as well, you know, in some countries you have censorship issues. You know, as I tell people, you know, there's two types of broadcasters. There's the public broadcaster, and then you have the state broadcaster, which is basically just says whatever information whoever is in power at the time. When you have people, let's say, that come from this kind of environment, is it very challenging, let's say, to educate them on, okay, this is what you have to do? I mean, how do you deal with people, let's say, that come from, say, areas of the world where, you know, journalists are attacked, journalists are heavily censored?
I mean, it's obviously a big issue for many journalists working for media organizations around the world. What kind of freedom do they have? What kinds of censorship are they having to cope with? And as you rightfully say, in many countries, there are quite strict controls. Sometimes they're controls which somebody tells you what you can and cannot say. In other cases, it's more you have to feel that yourself, much more difficult situation to work in. I mean, our experience is that many of the journalists or program makers who will come to attend RNTC courses are very much aware of what their situation is. And it's not so much a question of saying you must do this, because often they know their own situation much better than we do. They also know the kinds of risks that are involved, for heaven's sake. And it's not easy for us then. We can sit here in the Netherlands and say comfortably, we feel you ought to be doing this. But if somebody is putting their life on the line, or the security of their friends and family on the line, then it's something that you have to bear in mind. So our approach is very much to say, well, these are ways in which you could work. Let's look at possibilities rather than telling you one way of working. And of course, I mean, Keith, don't forget, we're strictly speaking there probably about news and current affairs, where those kinds of issues impinge and really play a role. But a lot of the courses that we also offer have to do with, if you like, areas of program making or areas of media activity outside that narrow field of news and current affairs. And we can think of educational programming. We can think of drama. We can think of factual programming, so informative program, to do with health and things like this. So there are lots of areas of program making which are less vulnerable to the censor, and which can people actually get a room to do a lot more than they can do in the narrow news and current affairs field. And helping people think like that and do that is also very much part of what we're doing.
So from what I understand, it's sort of from the start to the finish process of a production, everything from script writing to sound editing or video editing, mixing. It really covers everything that's involved in a production then.
Yeah, we do. I mean, don't forget, we have, of course, different lengths of courses. I mean, the maximum length of a course is 12 weeks. So during 12 weeks, you can obviously cover a lot. You can do a lot. But we also have courses that are only a week. And of course, that's much more limited in terms of what you can achieve during that week. Our Follow the Money course, which is, for instance, coming up later this year from October the 12th to the 16th, targets broadcast managers. And it's very much about financial management. So it's thinking about how you handle the money that you have responsibly, and also how you look at the possibility of generating revenue for your organization. But that's only a week, so you can't cover the full range of stuff that you can in a 12-week course. So, you know, there are lots of differences depending on the course that that we're actually offering and the course that people are taking part in.
Now, the courses that RNTC has, who pays for them? I mean, is it the participants themselves who you know, pay for the course, or are there scholarships?
Well, we're trying to encourage more and more people to either pay their own way, to pay their participation, so come up and pay the course fee themselves, or to find a sponsor. It could be their own organization, or they might find another organization in their own country which is prepared to sponsor them. And that's something we're definitely trying to encourage. At the same time, we have a long tradition of a relationship with the Netherlands Fellowship Programs, which is a Dutch government scholarship program, which basically sponsors nationals of 62 countries spread out over Africa, Asia, former Eastern Europe, Latin America, the Caribbean. And they can then apply as a national of those countries for a scholarship which pays for their travel, it pays for their accommodation and meals while they're here, and it pays the course fee. The only thing that their employer has to do for the organization they're working for, the media organization they're working for, is continue to pay their salary. That's the contribution they make while they're here. And that is quite a favorable program. Of course, many more people apply for an NFP scholarship than scholarships are available, so it's competitive, but it does, in any case, make it possible for many people who couldn't otherwise pay an RNTC course fee or pay to come here to do so. And that's something, you know, we still continue to encourage people from those 62 countries to do. And many of those countries, of course, are not necessarily English-speaking countries. RNTC courses are English language courses, but many of them come from non-English speaking countries, but have sufficient English to be able to apply and take a course here.
You were just talking about the Follow the Money course, which is going to be on from the 12th to 16th of October this year. And you were saying it's about management. How do you deal with the situation? Because, you know, people, you know, I've spoken to radio managers in countries like Indonesia and Vietnam, where corruption is a big problem. I mean, how do you take, let's say, how does somebody take what they learn there and bring it back to their own country, but it's a completely different environment, especially when money's involved?
I think that comes really back to the point I was making earlier, that we're not in the business of telling people how they should work or imposing a particular framework. A lot of what we're doing is discussing possibilities, different ways of working, and different ways of working work in different ways for different people, if you see what I mean. So it's not a question of saying this is the way you should work. There is one way, the Radio Netherlands way, or, you know, the BBC way, or the Deutsche Welle way, or it happens to be. No, there are different ways of doing things depending upon the context in which you're working. And a lot of the value too of a course like Follow the Money and courses for broadcast management is actually meeting other broadcast managers from around the world and sharing their experience and their situations, your experience with them, and hearing about them. So a lot of the learning that takes place in these courses is not just from course leaders and guest lecturers to the participants, but also from the participants and amongst the participants themselves. So that's very valuable. And a problem like corruption, of course, I mean, you may come from an Asian country where that's the case, but it's interesting then to talk maybe to somebody from Nigeria where it's a problem and hear how they're dealing with it and how they're coping with it and what it implies. So that too is, you know, very much value added, I think.
Well, that's actually quite interesting, because it's almost in many ways that people are not just learning something on the course, but they're also connecting with people in the field. They're exchanging ideas, and, you know, because of the exchange of ideas, it may help them in their own situation.
Absolutely, and creating a network, and that's what we find as well. Of course, that after these courses, participants remain in contact with one another, and not only through the RNTC Facebook page, which we have, but of also, you know, independently from one another. They may be getting in contact to say, well, I've got this problem now. How are you dealing with that? So a lot of a lot of the value of the course is also in what happens afterwards and the network that people have gained. And also the sense, I think, particularly for broadcast managers, you know, good Lord, I thought I was alone with this problem. I thought it was only my problem. And now I'm hearing that, in fact, lots of other people have the same problem and they're trying to deal with it in their way. And that I think, is also very much about the value, if you like, of sharing experience and exchanging ideas with other people from your profession.
During the course of the year, how many courses does RMTC have?
Well, at a quick count, I think we're up to about 19 or 20.
19 or 20?
Yeah, in total. I'm looking at, we now run sort of academic years, you know, so our academic year starts really in September and runs right the way through till August of the following year. And if we include also the summer school programs that we run for students with the University of Utrecht, sort of very practical stuff like multimedia storytelling, smartphone reporting. We do a little week course on the magic of radio, which I'm sure you will be enthusiastic about and probably some of your listeners. Very important. Including those, we're probably up to about 19 or 20 courses in total now. And we're still expanding. We're still developing new courses. And part of what we want to encourage, and perhaps that's a message, please, also to your listeners, you know, if you have suggestions or ideas about courses which RMTC could run or could be developing and doing, please get in touch and let us know. Please go to our website anyway, you know, www.rntc.nl, and have a look at the courses we offer. But if you have suggestions and ideas for courses that you feel we could include in our curriculum, in the courses that we offer, please, please do make those suggestions.
Now, at the moment, are the courses only in English, or are they also done in other languages? I mean, if we take, let's say, an area of the world where media is growing at a very fast rate, let's say China, would you, let's say, have courses in Chinese?
It's not an idea at the minute, Keith, but certainly thinking about courses in other languages is something we're doing at the minute. Traditionally, you're right in saying that our courses are basic English language courses. We ran right at the beginning of our existence in 1968, 69, we ran a couple of courses in French and found that that didn't really work, partly because if you're sending people out on assignments while they're here in the Netherlands, it's tough to find enough people who can speak French. But gradually, as we're developing more courses which can be conducted either online or on the spot or combinations of on the spot and here in the Netherlands, we're thinking about other languages that we could turn those courses into. And particularly at the minute, we're thinking, for instance, of Spanish, or we're thinking of Arabic as being possibilities. But certainly Chinese would definitely be a possibility. Radio Netherlands has a Chinese journalists working for it. At the moment, as part of its new brief to promote free speech around the world. So I think definitely the potential for developing courses in other languages, including Chinese, is there. And I should say that there's something very important, too, is that we do also have an option to offer tailor-made courses. So if a specific organization or a group of organizations in another country around the world says, well, we'd like you to design training specifically for us or for a core group of journalists or program makers or managers or whatever, then of course we can look at the possibility of designing that course, tailoring it to their needs, but also maybe working it into the language that they would like it to be worked into.
Is RMTC funded from the same department as Radio Netherlands? I mean, last year Radio Netherlands suffered a massive cut and many people were laid off. What about RMTC?
Yeah, that's absolutely. No, we were always funded separately. In fact, we're both funded now. RNW is now also with us, being funded by the Dutch Ministry of Foreign Affairs, or Development Corporation in our instance, if you like. So we are now, both our funding is sourced from The Hague, although there are different, funding, pots, we would say, pots of money in The Hague, which we're being paid for out of. And RNTC's future is guaranteed up till the end of next year and the end of 2014. Mm-hmm. That funding is safe. But after 2014, we're very much going to be on our own. So we're going to have to, and that's what we're working on and have been working on for the last couple of years, of course, is developing new courses and developing ways that we can in the future continue to work as RNTC and to pay our own way without depending upon funding from The Hague.
So it's almost like, RNTC will become, let's say, almost like a commercial or private enterprise, you have to raise your own funds.
Well, certainly. I think the emphasis on perhaps commercial is probably not quite the way we would see it. We'd like to see the same commitment to the target groups that we now work for, so particularly from developing countries. And that means that we won't operate as a commercial training organization in the same way that, for instance, there are commercial training providers in the Netherlands or in other places in Europe. The kinds of course fees or the kinds of money that they demand for training is in a totally different ball game to what we are. So we want to keep that same commitment, but we will have to find other sources of funding. We can't, after 2014, depend upon funding from The Hague any longer. That's gone. So we are busy now trying to find other sources of funding which will enable us to keep the same commitment that we've had through all these years, more than 40 years now, to the people working in media in the parts of the world that we've been serving up to now.
Now, because of the areas that you're mainly working with, do you work with any international aid organizations?
What we certainly have the possibility of doing is looking for funding from international aid organizations. We're working also in partnership with a number of organizations in the Netherlands, which have a commitment to what's going on in developing countries. For instance, we have a partnership with the TMC Asser Institute in The Hague, which is specialized in international humanitarian law and therefore in the whole international justice area that I was talking about earlier. We have a working partnership with an organization in Delft, which focuses on water issues around the world. So we are developing partnerships in specialized areas which enable us to, if you like, complement our expertise in the media area with content expertise. And part of that also is looking for funding, maybe from international development organizations, which are prepared to commit funding to supporting the activities of media in the support of development. So that is also an area that we are also looking into. We also have a course which has just been recently developed called Using Media for Development, which is targeting NGOs and development NGOs, so non-governmental organizations which are working in the development field in countries around the world and who need to know a little bit more about how to make effective use of media, both on their own, but also in terms of collaborating with media organizations, so like you and me. What do you need to know about media organizations? How can you collaborate effectively with them? What are the problems, difficulties that ensue, and what do you need to bear in mind? So that is also something we're encouraging, which ties in a little bit with your question about working with development organizations.
Tony Wilkinson, thank you for joining us today.
Keith, it was my pleasure. Thanks very much, and all the best, and also to your listeners, wherever they may be.
And I was speaking there with Tony Wilkinson from the Radio Netherlands Training Center. If you want more information about them and the courses they offer, you can check them out online at www.rntc.nl. Once again, rntc.nl. Just a quick note, actually, about some test transmissions that we are doing. The test transmissions are on Sunday from 13 to 14 hours UTC, Sunday from 13 to 14 hours UTC, targeting Southeast and East Asia on 11750 kilohertz. That's 11750 kilohertz. And the power that we're using is 125 kilowatts. And this is coming from the Trincomalee site that was once used by Radio Deutsche Welle in Sri Lanka. We're going to be continuing these tests for another few weeks. You can find all the details at our own website, www.pcjmedia.com. That's www.pcjmedia.com. We may do a frequency change after this weekend because of some co-channel interference that we're having in certain areas, mainly Australia, New Zealand, the Pacific, and also the western coast of North America. The frequency that we have been using has been going very far. We have so many reports that came in from places that we didn't expect people can listen with a very strong signal. But there is some co-channel interference, so we may change frequency, but you can find the details at our website. All right, now, myself, I started off in radio when I was still a teenager. Yes, very young at the time. But not as young as our next guest, who started off when he was 13. Now, he didn't just start off in radio, which was what I did. No, he took it to a different level. He decided to start his own radio station, a radio station that falls under the Part 15 law of the Federal Communications Commission in the United States. Part 15 means you can have a radio station on FM at 100 milliwatts. And you don't need a license. Now, what is amazing, you may think, oh, 100 milliwatts is not a lot of power, but depending on your antenna and the antenna location, you can get sometimes 10, even maybe 15 kilometers away. His name is Roman Belvins, and he now joins us on the program.
Well, actually, it started a couple of years ago, back in early 2010. I was just sitting around one day, and it was just one of those things that just pops into your head. The, you know, what if I could do this question? You know, what if I could, what if I can accomplish this? It started out as, you know, it's, you know, just something. I mean, like, who would think to start a radio station? That's something I had. It just, because I was interested, I loved listening to radio. Even in this modern age where we have MP3s and computers and YouTube to listen to all types of music, I still, you know, I had a little connection with radio as a special medium to myself. But and there are kids out there today who are interested in it, and it just it's been around for a long, long time, so there's, you know, really no way to, you know, kind of get rid of it right now. I think it'll be here for a long time, but
you've done something that I think you've really taken it to a different level. I mean, anybody can come along and say, look, I'm going to start a radio station. You create a website, you just create a stream, and that's it. But you've really taken it to another level using LPFM, which, if anybody doesn't know, that stands for low-powered FM, correct?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, yeah, I really didn't know what I was doing in the beginning. And when I started this, Keith, I was in Florida, and the FCC has two states where their laws regarding radio, that they will crack down on you with an iron fist, in New Jersey and Florida. And, you know, I had no idea what I was doing. I just had an idea, and I decided to go on eBay and look up things to start radio stations. I knew really nothing about transmitters, nothing about broadcasting. I bought a cheap Chinese hilly-made transmitter, and I got a $20 antenna that came with it, you know, and I decided, oh, cool, this will be easy. I'll just hook this up to my computer and start broadcasting, you know, and it spewed off of that. It just came all from that little idea and just doing it, just going out there and doing it.
Now, in the United States, Roman, the U.S. has, the FCC has something called Part 15. Many of our listeners outside the U.S. right now won't know what that is, but Part 15 means does that really mean you're allowed to broadcast under a certain amount of power with no problem?
Well, you know, you put no problem under a specific, under a magnifying glass, you know, and no problem, you can get away with it. It's just really frowned upon, and they'll try to get you for anything. I mean, yes, the law says you can do it. It has to be under, I believe it's 100 milliwatts, that's what I'm putting out right now. And then they can't really do anything to you. But, of course, they'll try to find things to go around their Part 15 law to get you, like, interference, saying that it interferes with airline communications, et cetera, et cetera.
I have a funny story that happened last year when I was in Plymouth Meeting in the United States for this radio conference. I actually set up at the hotel a pirate radio station, and one of the guys that was attending there was actually from the FCC, and I didn't know that, and we just started talking, and then he said he was from the FCC, and I went, oh, I shouldn't be talking too much. And he told me, he said, well, personally, he said, we don't really care as long as it doesn't cause any interference. When somebody causes interference, that's when we have to investigate.
Now, remember how I told you earlier on how I bought that cheap Chinese-made transmitter in Florida?
Right.
Well, you know something about transmitters, I guess, and you know, when you buy something cheap, and this goes for all things, you usually get what you pay for. And I had no idea about FM transmitters when I got this thing. I plugged it up. I put the antenna outside my window. And this is when I was living in an apartment. So this thing was hanging on the side of my balcony. You know, we were on the third floor. And it was been going on for a week. I've been putting music from my computer. I hadn't had a mix board yet. No microphones. I was playing music off my iTunes. And all of a sudden, you know, my neighbors started complaining. They said, well, I don't know what happened. A couple of weeks ago, you know, my TV started acting up on all channels. I called the Dish people and they came and they didn't know what was going on, blah, blah, blah. And the lady was talking to my mother. And my mom told me, you know what, Roman? I think it's that little radio thing you've got going on. And it was. Every time I switched it on, their TV would go bad because it bled so bad. And now this was 15 watts of FM energy being distributed out of this transmitter. And it was affecting this whole entire neighborhood. I'm lucky that the FCC didn't come bust down my door because...
You could have used the excuse considering how bad television is. This would have been an improvement.
Lines going on the screen, colors and all. It's pretty nice looking.
Yeah. So you shut that down, but then when you left Florida... You brought the idea with you, and you're using a 100 milliwatt transmitter right now. Where did you get this transmitter from?
I had this person. He was like an electronics guy, and he was talking to me, and he told me about EDM and about their multiple transmitters. And I was looking on their website and all like that. And he had one, so I paid him, and he sent it to me. He said it won't interfere, won't get you caught, won't get you busted. It has a 10 milliwatt to 100 milliwatt range. So you'll be fine, and it is a pure, just clean, good working transmitter, and that's what I got.
And of course, one of the interesting things that people may not be familiar with, but even if you, 100 milliwatts doesn't sound like a lot, but with a decent antenna, depending on how high the antenna is, you can get pretty good coverage with that.
Yeah, you can. Because the antenna that I got with the Hilly was a ground plane, and it was a cheap one, and it really didn't work well. And it's all rusted now. That's how bad it is. But I went to the Home Depot, and which is a department store in the U.S. is a hardware store, and I got some copper poles, copper pipes actually, and I don't know. I don't really remember. I had charts or something. Someone online sent me an email how to cut them to the specific frequency.
Right.
To whatever it is. And, I wanted mine kind of in the middle. So I said, all right, why don't we just cut it to the frequency of 98.9? Because that way, if I decided to change frequencies, I can go up to like 101 something or down probably all the way to the upper 80s, and still get away with it. Just because you have to have your antenna cut a certain way on FM. For it to have the best results.
And that was Roman Belvins, who created Roman FM, a Part 15 station with 100 milliwatts in the United States, and he was only 13 at the time. He is now 15. And doesn't sound like a 15-year-old. Really brilliant guy. Very nice. And if you have any questions you want to ask him, he is part of the PCJ, what is it again? PCJ Media, PCJ Radio Facebook page. There we go, a blooper. I should know it, but I didn't. He is part of our Facebook page. So don't be afraid. Don't be shy. Go there and ask him a question. All right. Now, what can we expect with propagation over the next 7 days? Here's our propagation editor, Dan Hensley.
Here's propagation for the week from May 25th to May 31st, 2013. The 10.7 centimeter flex starts off at 120 on May 25th, 115 on May 26th, May 27th, 110, May 28th and 29th, 105, May 30th and 31st, 100. The A index is 5 from May 25th to May 27th, on May 28th spiking at 15, down to 10 on May 29th, an A index of 5 on May 30th and 31st. The KP index is 2 for the first 3 days of this week, from May 25th to May 27th, spiking at 4 on May 28th, down to 3 on May 29th, and then 2 on May 30th and 31st. 5 sunspots are passing out of view this week, 17, 44, 45, 46, 47, and 50. 1 sunspot remains this week, and that's 1748 with the Delta Class magnetic field that harbors energy for X-class flares. On May 20th, we had an M1 class flare from 1748. We'll see a solar wind from coronal hole on the sun's south-southwest region hit Earth on May 23rd and 24th. auroras over North America are passable, so get ready to passably work some FM, VHF, and UHF DX. Back to you, Keith.
All right, thank you very much, Dan, for this week's propagation forecast. And just to let you know that you can catch a radiogram of us here at PCJ on WRMI. The details are at our website, which has the propagation forecast and other information. Well, guess what? We are now out of time. If you wish to listen to this program again or catch all past editions and find information about our broadcasts from Trincomalee in Sri Lanka to Southeast and East Asia, visit our website, www.pcjmedia.com. That's www.pcjmedia.com. If you have any comments or questions, and of course we always like to get those, or any even, you know, story ideas, you can send those along as well. The email address for this program is mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. So on behalf of Dan Hensley and Paulette McQuarrie, who's away right now, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, hoping that you can join us again very soon for the monthly edition or the weekly edition next week on the World Radio Network, 73 and 88 to the ladies.